This is Seattle's Morning News. And now I'd like you to meet a Fox News host. Steve Hilton hosts The Next Revolution, Sunday nights on Fox. But he has an unusual background for a Fox host in that he's an immigrant, he has an accent, and served Her Majesty's government under the Iron Lady, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. What was your job there, Steve?
Well, actually, it was when I was just starting out on my career. I was a very junior intern in the Conservative Party headquarters, straight out of university, and I did basic policy research and tried to help out as much as I could. I then went on to be the campaign coordinator for a general election campaign. By that time, they'd actually replaced Margaret Thatcher with her successor, John Major. But I did have the honor of meeting her on a number of occasions, which was obviously a complete thrill.
You've written a book called Positive Populism. I noticed right away that for some people in the Fox audience, this was too much for them. They went after you. They essentially called this false flag populism, that it's actually socialism. So what do you mean by positive populism?
So I think that that's a minority view, because generally speaking, we talk about these things on the show every week, and we have a very loyal audience and are doing very well, I'm pleased to say. Populism for me is an agenda, a policy agenda, which is pro-worker, pro-family, pro-community, and pro-America. And you may hear that and say, well, who's against that?
Exactly.
That's just a platitude. Well, actually, I'll tell you who's against that. The people who've been in charge for the last few decades. Because whether you've had Republican administrations or Democratic administrations, the policy agenda that's been pushed through from Washington especially has not been pro-worker. Workers have seen their jobs go away and their incomes go down. It has not been pro-family. Families have been undermined, and family breakdown has continued to accelerate. It's certainly not been pro-community. Communities have had their power taken away, resources taken away from them. Community breakdown is happening all over the country. And, of course, it has not been pro-America, because we've had a globalist approach taken where that's been the priority, not what's best for this country. And so although it sounds an easy and simple thing to say, if we changed the direction of policymaking to be pro-worker, pro-family, pro-community, and pro-America, that would be a real revolution. And it's ideas to bring that about, specific policy ideas, that I've set out in this new book, Positive Populism.
And you're saying the problem is the elite. Now, is this based on your experience in the British government?
I'm a member of the elite. Anyone who's had the chance to work in government, and then I've taught at Stanford and I've started a business and so on, yeah, I would say I'm a part of the elite, but I'm not an elitist. Elitism is a specific ideology, a set of beliefs and policies that help the elite and hurt working people. That's a really big difference between the elite and elitism.
Well, give me an example of that, how that works.
The key components of the elitist ideology, I would say, as I set out in the book, are an enthusiasm for globalization, for automation, for centralization, for centralizing power in terms of government, but also the economy, where you see big corporations getting bigger and bigger, and also uncontrolled immigration. Those are the four things, I think, that is this elitist consensus, which, irrespective of whether you've had Democrats or Republicans in charge, basically that agenda is what was pushed through over the last few decades. And that's why so many people looked at elections and said, well, it doesn't really matter who we put in charge. Yeah. It's the same people who seem to be in power with the same ideas. For example, if you take the period between 2000 and 2016 and looked at what happened to household income in America, the median household income, the midpoint in the scale of incomes, actually fell during that period. So people rightly say, look, what does it matter who's in charge? We've had 8 years of Bush and 8 years of Obama, and at the end of all that, the rich got richer and half the country got poorer. That's not just a slogan from a political campaign. Those are the facts. And that's why I think you had this populist uprising, which you see in terms of support for Donald Trump, also for Brexit in the UK and now elsewhere around the world, where people are saying we want a real change. We want working people's interests to come first, not this elitist agenda, which has been great for the people at the top, the people who work in what they describe as the knowledge economy, who are in the thriving urban centers. They've done really well out of this elitist globalist agenda. But regular working people have not. And it's time, I'm arguing, to put their interests first. That's why I say it is pro-worker, because we have not seen that over the last few years.
Okay, well, I mean, the biggest change we had under Trump was getting rid of the corporate income tax, which has certainly lifted the stock market. Oh, I know there's some disagreement whether that gets the credit or not. But most, half the Americans are not invested in the stock market. And while wages have gone up between 2 and 3%, I'm given to understand that if we had been paid according to the increase in our productivity, the minimum wage would be, what, $20, $30, $40 an hour. So, I mean, what do you do about that?
Yeah, there's a number of things that I just want to disentangle. So, first of all, the connection between productivity and wages is an incredibly important one and has become completely disconnected. It used to be the case that three things in America went up in parallel: economic growth, productivity, and the incomes for workers. But that relationship stopped in the early 1970s, since when incomes have been basically flat or falling for the 80% or so of Americans who are not managers and supervisors, while the economic growth has gone up substantially and so has productivity. And one of the reasons for that is the concentration of power in the economy, where big companies have got bigger and bigger, meaning that there's less competition for labor. They've been more able to impose unfair working practices, for example, requiring that their workers sign non-compete agreements, stopping them from going and getting a better wage somewhere.
So you get rid of that and break up big companies?
Of course you have to do that. Those are some of the ideas in my book. Of course you have to stop.
Seriously? Where would you find the political will to do that? So break up Microsoft, break up Google, break up...
But not just that. I mean, everyone talks about big tech, but you have to break up the insurance companies and the airlines and the pharmaceutical companies and the... It's in every sector. Wherever you look, the housing construction, you see it in food and drink, you see right through the economy, one after another, you've seen these giant corporations buy up their competitors and act against the public interest, against
right.
their workers.
But wouldn't that be defined as punishing success?
No, because what success is all about, and this is the essence of America and the free market system and the dynamism of capitalism, is competition. That's what it's about, markets and competition. And we don't have that anymore. When people talk about a rigged market, it resonates because everyone knows it's true. It is not free market. It is not capitalist to say we're okay with the fact that in industry after industry, you have these giant companies that protect their interests and act against the public interest. And by the way they do it is by forming this axis of elitism with big government. So they're all in the swamp together, hanging out with the lobbyists. And the companies give the political donations to the big corporations, and then they give jobs to the legislative aides, and then the members of Congress serve on the committees, and they get donations from those industries that they regulate. The whole thing is totally corrupt, and we've got to break that power structure. So my book sets out how you can do that right across the board. It's not just one thing you have to do. Yes, you have to have much tougher antitrust regulation and enforcement. Yes, you have to break up these big companies, but you also have to deal with the corruption. So there are plans in my book for how you deal with all of that. You can't just do one thing and hope that you'll change this power structure that's been developing over many, many years.
Well, I mean, people elected Donald Trump to accomplish the goals that you have outlined, but I don't see any indication they're talking about breaking up big companies.
It's just one election, one person. The whole point of my book is to say, let's turn this into a real, lasting movement that's deep and broad and encompasses a range of policies, not just the signature policies that Donald Trump campaigned on, trade deals and immigration and so on. It's right across the board.
Well, let's talk about it. Let's not just jump
also,
past immigration.
That's another reason I think that I really wanted to put this book out there and start this conversation, because in order to make these revolutionary changes, we need a real movement behind it. And that movement needs to produce people who are going to run for office at every level, year after year, decade after decade. That's the only way you're going to take back power. You're not going to do it with one presidential candidate in one election. That's ridiculous. You know, can see right now what's going on, where you have where Congress isn't lining up behind because they completely disagree with most of the aims that Donald Trump ran on. You have the permanent bureaucracy, the administrative state, all trying to block him from delivering his promises. You know, all this is, you know, this is a really deep problem. And the idea that you're just going to turn it around with one election is ridiculous.
Okay, let's just take two of your bullet points here, immigration and health care. So tell me, give me the thumbnail of how you'd handle the immigration problem.
Well, I think the problem with immigration is that it's been out of control. I think that America, as I can testify, you know, I'm an immigrant actually twice over. My family was, my family are Hungarian. That's my roots. And they were refugees from communism and my parents ended up in England. And that's where I was born and raised. Grateful for that incredible opportunity. And then now we moved here 6 years ago. I'm an immigrant here in America. And we all agree that the essence of America is that dynamic melting pot. But that's been completely broken in the last, again, not just the last few years, but a few decades, where people sense that the immigration system is not being controlled. I've always made the argument that people are pro-immigration. There's public consent for immigration as long as immigration is controlled. And if it's a free-for-all, then you lose that public consent because people can see the impact on the economy and on their prospects. And that is exactly what's been going on. And it's not just Donald Trump who made that argument, remember. It was also Bernie Sanders. He was very strong on this issue. In 2015, he gave an interview where he basically described open borders as a Koch brothers proposal, a conservative proposal to help corporate America get cheap labor at the expense of working Americans and young people, especially African Americans and Hispanics, who are trying to get
right, but
jobs.
But that fight has devolved into a fight over a wall. I mean, controlling immigration, most immigration or illegal immigration, is because people overstay their visas. It's not because
it is. That's right.
And all right.
So you need to improve the system. But also, there's a huge problem with the way the immigration courts work. They're woefully underfunded. There's massive backlog. The whole system is incompetently run and inhumane. It needs a complete overhaul so that people can have confidence that the system is being properly run. Now, who's responsible for that? It's Congress, because they're the people who pass the laws and allocate the money. So this is a long-standing problem that our leaders in Washington have totally failed
to
do.
Well, I'm told that if they took a vote today, there'd be a bipartisan consensus on an immigration reform that would do a lot of the things that you say. Would probably not build a wall, but it would...
But where is it? Where's it been then the last few years?
Well, the Gang of Eight came up with it, but they, of course, when those kids showed up at the border right before the vote, that killed it.
Yeah, but there was no support for that, as I understand it, in the House.
Well, that's because they won't bring it up. They won't even bring it up. If they would pass the House today, is my understanding, if the Republicans would bring it up. They don't want to bring it up because they don't want to pass anything with Democratic support.
Nobody believes that the actual first step in that plan, which is border security, will actually ever be taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Again, going in line with what I understand to be the best traditions of America, and the thing that makes America special is that you come to America, anyone can become an American.
Right.
That is not true of anywhere else. You can leave and move to Britain, but you'll never be British, not really. You know, you try going to Hungary, where I'm from, and living there, you know, even for 20 years, they'll never let you become a Hungarian. If you go to China, they won't let you be. You're not going to become Chinese. It's very different. There's something special about America, which you can come here and play your part in the story of this incredible country and become American. That's all about integration. It's all about the melting pot. And that's been lost as well, where we've been casual about things like people learning English and making sure people are aligned with the values of this country and sign up to them and abide by them. That's incredibly important, and we've got to insist on that.
But we've also sent a message to immigrants here that there's a certain culture which, if you're not part of it, you're not truly American. That's the tragedy to me. I mean, my grandparents were immigrants from Italy, and they became American, but they hung on to their culture, and we were cool with that. You know, there was a little Italy, and
that's exactly right. That's what the melting pot's all about.
So, but now you have, and this, of course, manifests itself with Islam. People come here from Islamic countries. They might wear the veil. They might wear the abaya. And people look at them funny. What are you doing? Well, what they're doing is they're being Americans but dressing differently. And that's my problem with the way immigration has been taken. There are all these signals that, yes, oh, you're an American, but only if you dress the right way and eat at McDonald's.
Well, I don't agree with that personally. I don't think that's got anything to do with what I believe in. But I think also there's a real warning from the UK and elsewhere in Europe where it's much deeper than dress, where you have whole communities where nobody speaks English, deliberately so, because the men want to stop the women from participating fully in society. They don't want them going out and getting jobs. And so that's a real problem.
Right. Well, in America, that's illegal. You can't stop somebody from getting a job. You're not supposed to discriminate based on sex. But I'm
learning English.
Do you think this should be mandated then? I mean, we do that. If you're going to be naturalized as a citizen, you have to have an understanding of English.
Yes, and I think that's right. But you see in lots of, I mean, a friend of mine, Rehan Salam, is out with a book soon. You should talk to him about this. Very interesting book, where he makes the argument that actually the people who've really are starting to lose out from the way the immigration system has been operated and the way that integration has not been a priority are actually immigrants themselves. And that story of rising up and climbing the ladder of opportunity in America is just not true for too many immigrants who are here and social mobility for them has stalled. This is a really big problem.
Yeah. Now, I want to get on to healthcare because time's limited, and this is something that's got people feeling really insecure and wondering what's going to happen after Obamacare. So I take it that your idea is to put more competition in the healthcare system, especially in among pharmaceuticals. But do you include in that a guarantee that you will not ever be bankrupted by your illness and that you will get treatment even if you've had a pre-existing condition?
Of course, but I think I go much further than that. The issue, I think, is that we've muddled up two things that are very different into one pretty toxic debate. And those two things are health insurance and health care. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem. What people need and want in terms of health care, I think, can and should be delivered by the market. Because I believe that choice, not just belief, it's a question of belief, it's the evidence of every other sector, where you have competition, where you have more choice, consumer choice, you end up with better products, more innovation, lower costs. It's a good dynamic. So in health care, you need more competition and more choice. But when it comes to insurance, people don't want choice or competition. They just want to be covered. They just want to know that if they get sick, they'll be treated. If their child gets sick, they're not going to have to go bankrupt in order to save them. And that is a very deep human need that I think we should take care of. And so my answer is to separate the two things and implement what I would describe as universal free market healthcare. Universal because everybody's covered by taxpayers funding, a taxpayer guarantee, and that can be achieved a number of different ways. There are different models you can look at around the world for how that is done, social insurance systems and so on. But the actual delivery of healthcare is done by the market. And that's why it's not the same as just simply saying a single-payer system like the UK, because the UK system, you have the government delivering all of the healthcare through the National Health Service. Now, I've experienced trying to reform that in government precisely because although there are many examples of fantastic care and treatment in the British National Health Service, there are also terrible, shocking stories of bureaucratic incompetence, you know, which is inevitable when you have literally one organization with around a million employees. I think it's the third or fourth biggest employer in the world, the British National Health Service. So I don't think that's the route to go down, but I do think that we can make progress beyond what seems to be completely stuck debate. The other thing that I notice about this whole problem is that the health insurance model that we have now is a huge burden on business. I run a business here. I started a business here in America. It's incredible to me that I have to start worrying about my employees' health care. That's really intrusive and a burden, a bureaucratic burden on companies. Plus, it's a barrier to labor mobility because if your health insurance is tied to your employer, that makes, again, that jams up the works of the economy. So I think that we've got to separate health insurance from health care, and that's the way to make progress.
So you would stop these contracts between insurance companies and hospitals with the huge list prices and the incomprehensible discounts.
There wouldn't be insurance companies in that
exactly.
sense.
Okay, so let me ask you then. You would have a market where it would be a completely free market, so I could choose any doctor, I could choose any hospital, I could look at the list, I would choose that doctor, and the government would pay the bill so I don't get bankrupt. Is that correct?
Yes.
How then would you prevent me from choosing the most expensive hospital, the most expensive doctor, and bankrupting the whole system?
Well, there's a number of ways that you'd have to, you know, ration that. I mean, there's no you have to have acceptable prices. That's the system.
Then you're talking about controlling that free market in some way.
Of course.
Oh, okay.
Because it's otherwise exactly as you say. You get, but you know, we accept that in schools, for example. I mean, all I'm asking for is the kind of vision of school choice, for example, that you have, that the conservatives, that really, you know, free market people believe should happen in education. We don't have education insurance for schools. It's just free.
Well, right. But I mean, school's not a matter of life and death. I mean, when you got cancer, you're talking about your existence, not whether you're going to pass the SAT.
Yes. But the idea that people want the most expensive is not correct. They want there are other factors. There's convenience, there's effectiveness, and also if you transparently publish data.
No, I'm saying that, people don't want the most expensive. They want the best. But what hospitals will do, because we know how they behave, if somebody else is paying, right, other than the one making the choice, they will charge the maximum amount. And
the government can cap the amounts.
So you will cap it. All right. So this is not really a free market. It's a regulated market.
There isn't a free market for anything anyway, literally.
Well, okay, but you mentioned free market, so I just wanted to clarify that. We're not talking about...
Okay, but you give me an example of where there's a free market anywhere in the world in anything.
I'm not. I can't. That's
right, because there isn't. It's a term that's used.
What I'm saying is that the people who...
Competitive market.
What I'm saying is most of the people who take the line that you have, who classify themselves as conservatives and want to reform healthcare, believe in a free market. The libertarians say, don't regulate anything, make it a free market, but you pay, not the government.
It's a massive burden on the economy. I mean, that's why American healthcare costs twice as much as anywhere else in the world for roughly the same outcomes.
Because it's not regulated.
No, because it's a free-for-all. I mean, why do doctors in America get paid twice as much as doctors anywhere else? Do people live twice as long? Are people twice as healthy?
No,
it's a cartel. There's not competition. There's not choice.
Right. Am I correct, since I've got somebody who grew up in Great Britain, am I correct that as much as you know there are problems with your National Health Service, you would not get rid of it?
No one would want to get rid of it. You want to reform it and improve it, just like you would want to reform and improve things here. You know, people, you don't just want to sort of complete... overhaul of it. What you want is to make sure that the system works better. Right now, the problem with the National Health Service is that it is not delivering the kind of care that people expect in all cases. We, when working in government, tried to implement a reform of the National Health Service precisely to move in the direction that I've been outlining here, to bring more choice and competition so that you have more innovation, especially when you have these incredible transformations in medical technology just around the corner, telemedicine and so on, that can really transform the cost, massively reduce the cost of healthcare. The way that gene science is going to make it much, much more effective to sort of map the impact of different medicines and treatments for individual people. There's a huge transformation coming in medicine. And in order to get the benefit of that, you want a proper competitive system with innovation in there. And we don't the UK, that doesn't happen because it's one giant bureaucratic system. And in the US, it doesn't happen because it's stitched up by a small number of companies.
Yeah. I'll tell you this. I had the occasion to visit Stepping Hill Hospital near, Buxton, a few years back. And there were open wards there. Americans will never accept hospitals with open war. They want private rooms.
Right.
Has Trump tweeted about this yet?
No. About what?
About your book.
No, he hasn't. No. I'm not in touch with him. Let's put it that way.
Well, he fashions himself as a populist, and there are some ideas he ought to consider in your book.
Right. Well, maybe it'll get to him somehow.
Steve Hilton is the host of The Next Revolution, Sundays on Fox, and the author of Positive Populism. Thanks, Steve.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.